Accession number 13075, reel 3.
When it went on the Mark II Vulcan, I suppose the Mark II Vulcan was the biggest high-altitude aeroplane in the world, perhaps, without any vortex generators on the wings, because this conical camber did the trick.
Now, this would have made virtually a complete wing redesign.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. That's why it couldn't be incorporated on the Mark I, although we knew how to do it. It had to wait for the next batch, called the Mark II.
You referred earlier to a stall on one of the 707s. I mean, my understanding of the Delta Wing is that you never stall, you just sink. Was that true on the 707?
Well, it was... true to a certain extent, but if the CG was sufficiently far aft, and if you got enough pitching power, and if you held the stall position long enough so that its incidence increased by virtue of its rate of descent, it would eventually stall. Mm-hmm. Not to be recommended because of its proclivity for trying to spin.
Because the Americans had an equivalent called the Convair XF-92. And every American pilot I've spoken to has got nothing but curses for it. I mean, that was totally underpowered. I'm not sure whether it was conical camber or not.
No, I can't remember.
I think it was. I saw it actually in the back of an old hangar at Wright-Patterson when I was
really?
There. And they were renewing it. You know, there's a huge American Air Force museum there.
Yes.
They've got a whole shed of aeroplanes long since forgotten that,
yes,
that they were renovating. But, now, this conical camber idea, essentially... we're talking about looking at a wing section as part of a cone, the surface of a cone.
Yes.
I mean, if you extended,
yes,
the wing in, yes, theory, beyond,
yes,
its tips,
yes,
they would meet.
True.
Below.
True.
And complete a cone.
Yes.
Now, this presumably has an effect of trapping air in it, particularly near the ground. I mean, when you see a Concorde land, you can see the traces in the vortices.
Yes, you can.
It's sitting on a cone of air, really.
Yes, yes, yes. Ground effect, as it's called, was not particularly noticeable in the Vulcan, although I suppose some landings which might have been indifferent were cushioned by it to an extent.
Mm. Because this was another case of Wright-Patterson as well. They've got the surviving... XB-93, the Valkyrie.
Yes.
And that was designed to lower the outer sections of the wing in flight,
yes,
by about 15 degrees.
Really?
Which would give it a sort of camber. I mean, not a true conical camber,
yes,
but again, the same aerodynamic
effect, yes,
that it would sit on it.
Yes.
In the air.
Yes. You see, the advantage of the conical camber and kinked leading edge meant that the effective sweep at the tips was increased. Reduced inboard. And of course, it was the increased sweep at the tips which prevented the shock stall at the tip, which cured the buffeting problem. When I say cured, I mean allowed for much more maneuverability before the onset of buffeting.
And in a way, it resembled the Victor's wing, which was this.
Dubby wouldn't have liked to hear you say that.
The fact that you virtually managed to get a uniform thickness chord ratio from tip right through the roof.
Yes, yes.
By,
yes,
varying the sweep of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I want to go back to your time when you joined Avro's, and you said there was tremendously high morale.
Yes.
At that time, this probably was not only due possibly to Dobby's leadership, but also the exciting new areas you were moving into.
Oh, yes.
In the flight regime.
Oh, absolutely.
And the sort of resources you had to build.
The sort of...
The resources you had to build those miniature prototypes to,
yes,
sort out problems.
Yes.
That would otherwise have been too expensive to modify on the big bird.
Yes.
The big Vulcan.
Yes. Yes. And not only too expensive, but infinitely more quickly achieved. I can't remember his name, and even if I could, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you. I shouldn't tell you. But I once read an article in a magazine by a famous aviation writer who dismissed the 707s as being quite useless in the development of Vulcan because they were far too late to be of any use in this program. And had I not been lazier, I would have written to that magazine and said, funny you should say that. I was looking at my logbook the other day, and I find that I was flying 7 days a week, 3 and 4 times a day on the 707, which was being used to develop the new wing shape for the Vulcan. It being a very much faster job on a little airplane than on the massive tenth
now,
of an acre.
Nowadays, of course, you'd have computers instead.
Yes, yes, yes. Then it was a case of suck it and see.
Exactly.
Yes.
But that, to me, from an engineering point of view, was a very, very exciting era.
Oh, it was. It was. You see, if I can just tell you one story. In the early days of Vulcan, we had a rather naughty bomber command liaison officer with us who used to do his best to get me into trouble in certain ways. And if we saw a contrail, he would reckon that it was a B-47. Go on, Jim. Catch it up.
Oh, you'd be in the air, yeah.
Right. Mm. And so we would chase this B-47. And then with our air brakes out to show that we had to slow down to keep down to its speed, we'd sit alongside it, watch the crew looking up through their perspex canopy. And then Podge would say, right, now. And so we'd close the air brakes, blast the throttles, pull up in front of them, do a roll. We did this on one occasion a couple of weeks before the Farnborough show, and in the Avro chalet, a United States Air Force general asked to be put in touch with someone to do with Vulcan, and I was introduced to him. And the gist of his message was, would you please ask your Vulcan crews to keep away from my goddamn B-47s? All my B-47 crews want to do is get their ass into a goddamn Vulcan. Which, coming from an American, at that time, I think paid a great tribute to the enormous success of the Vulcan.
This is not to denigrate the B-47, of course.
Not to denigrate the B-47 in one way, shape or form. And, of course, it was, I suppose, as a result of that conversation that I realised we had been very naughty, because, in fact, they were on a bombing run to a radar target in Liverpool. So no doubt we were putting them off their stroke, rather.
Well, I don't think naughtily. Your turbulence helped them. Yes, now you've mentioned the Vulcan roll, and I've seen it at Farnborough, but that was quite extraordinary. The fact that nothing came off was that you had a very sound, solid wing, wasn't it?
I don't think so. I got into trouble with the managing director of the day, but I forecast that this might happen, and I had a time history from the instrumentation showing all of the details of a roll. And I said to Jimmy Kay, who was managing director at the time, the late Jimmy Kay, well, you must come along and try it for yourself sometime. But in the meantime, there's a time history. And the G doesn't vary by more than 0.8 to 1.2. So there's no undue stresses and strains on it at all. It just looked sensational from the ground.
Because I remember Boeing 707s, the airliner rather than your Delta, went into involuntary rolls.
Did it?
In early flight training.
Really?
And shed engines.
Really?
Before they had your dampers in. They took it up too high in the flight envelope.
Yes.
And on training flights. Yeah. I think they were doing engine arts, that's it.
Yes.
On swept wings.
Yes, yes.
And they put out two on one side and the whole thing rolled. And the engines were. But, I mean, again, praise to Boeing structural engineering, that plane landed. With all the engines gone on one side.
Remarkable.
Tell me more about the Vulcan. Is there more to be told? What was its performance in the end? What was its cruising altitude, critical Mach number?
Well, that wing alone, that Mark II wing, that itself put 2,000 feet on the cruise climb ceiling, even without the bigger, more powerful Olympus engines that were fitted to the Mark II. so that, you know, with four times 20,000 pounds of thrust, and for demonstration purposes, you could get the weight down to about 100, 110,000 pounds, the thrust-weight ratio was absolutely astronomical. The highest I ever had of Vulcan was 62,500 feet. Not much fuel left, I must admit. Critical Mach number, well, of course, in those days one was never absolutely certain of position errors, but I dare say the fastest we ever went was in the region of 9.6 or 9.7. And that was dictated solely by the increasing nose-down trim change, which I referred to, such that an extra 005 in Mach number might require full back stick. And when searching for the limiting speed, I well remember having to say to the Bomber Command liaison officer I was referring to a moment ago, pull, Podge, pull. And having shed 005, it quickly became necessary to say, no, push, push, push. Again, of course, this was way beyond the limits which were set to the service.
Did you get it beyond Mach 1?
No.
Because there were stories about that Rowley Falk had done it.
Oh, no, nothing like that.
You had to hop out of the Vulcan once, didn't you?
Yes.
Could you tell me about it?
It was in, I think I'm right in saying, in 1958, in a Mark 1, XA895, which was being used not only to do the bigger Olympus engine development, but also as an electrical development aircraft for the Mark 2. The Mark 1 Vulcan was a DC aeroplane. The Mark II was an AC aeroplane.
Electric wire.
Yes. And we had an experimental installation in the Mark I, which was going to become standard for the Mark II. And on one occasion, it let us down rather badly on takeoff from Woodford. With those enormous engines, it was almost obligatory to show off on takeoff, and so a steep climbing turn off the runway, up onto the downwind leg, and Bob Pogson, the AEO, looking after the electrics in the back, said, I have bad news for you, Jim. Three generators have failed, the fourth is failing, and your batteries are flat. Well, there was no way we could chance landing back at Woodford, because that would have meant coming in over Poynton town. And so we set course over the hills, and I summoned the chief designer and his team to the air traffic, and we had a long dialogue with them, hoping that they would be able to suggest some magic. In the meantime, the aeroplane was not flying at all well. The wing went down 5 or 10 degrees. It was necessary to have full stick throw, and after a while it would come up again. And so we were limping out towards open country. It became fairly clear that we were probably not going to succeed in mending the situation. And so we invited two of the rear crew members to bail out, which they did. And Bob Pogson, manning the electrics, said to me, it's rather noisy with the door open, shall I close it? And I said, yes, but do be careful, Bob. And if I forget, perhaps you'll remind me in a moment to tell you the end of that story. Well, things progressively deteriorated. We had vague hopes of landing at one of the bomber command stations at Waddington, and in fact were talking to them when the situation deteriorated with dramatic suddenness. And with the stick fully forward, the nose was rearing up. And so it was a case of mayday, mayday, mayday. And I landed in a field with a slightly twisted ankle. We were wearing high-altitude, partial-pressure clothing.
What height were you at when you...
About 14,000 feet only. Uh-huh. We were wearing partial-pressure clothing because we were going to very high altitude. And so I limped to the edge of the field, lay down still wearing my helmet, and I became aware that a car had stopped. And I could hear a voice saying, "Oh, poor chap, he's all done in." And I opened one eye and said, "Do you smoke?" Because I was on 30 a day in those days. And much to my surprise, not only did they say they hadn't got any cigarettes, but they couldn't wait because they were going shopping. So they drove away, and presently a workman's van came along, and I asked the same question. They hadn't got any cigarettes, but they could offer me a swig of lemonade if I wanted. And then a police car arrived, and I was loaded aboard, and we set off racing down country lanes, which seemed to be highly dangerous. And then I became aware of a chopper overhead, and I said, "Well, you'd better stop. I think he might be looking for me." And I climbed out and sat on a five-bar gate and waved my handkerchief. The chopper came in, picked me up, took me to Leconfield, where I was absolutely delighted to find the whole of the crew, because it was the first time ever that an entire crew had escaped from any of the three V bombers. And talking to them over a jar or two in the mess, I asked Bob Pogson how he'd got on. He said, "Well, I was in so much hurry when you said bail out that I forgot to put the door handle in the emergency position, and as I slid down it, it was progressively closing." So I managed to extrude myself through a very, very narrow gap. Well, that's the story of bailing out.
Now, you, someone was sitting, you were in the left-hand seat?
Yes.
Someone is in the right-hand seat.
Right, Dickie Proudlove by name, one of our flight test observers, but he had been an RAF pilot.
And you both ejected?
We both ejected, yes.
Now, this has been the very thorny problem on all V-bombers, if you had an emergency at low level, isn't it? Can you tell me a bit about that? Because it does strike me as not making for very good crew morale when you design an aeroplane where only two have got a sporting chance of escaping from after you.
Yes. Yes, that's a fair comment. I think it was not, of course, peculiar to the Vulcan. That was the situation with all the V-bombers. I suppose one didn't really envisage having to bail out from particularly low level. There was considerable talk after the event about installing ejection seats for the rear crew members, but it came to naught. And obviously this was a decision taken on high. And I don't think that it is true to say that rear crew member morale was necessarily low, quite the contrary, from my contacts with Vulcan squadrons.
Because there was the accident at Heathrow, and then there was another accident at Sewell, wasn't there?
Yes. Yes, Heathrow was very, very sad because they were on their way back from Australia, where Podge Howard, the chap I'd referred to earlier, had made some remarkable demonstrations and high-speed runs and breaking a few records, Australia to New Zealand and so on. And Sir Harry Broadhurst was in the right-hand seat, as they approached London. And
Who was flying in the left?
Podge Howard, Squadron Leader Howard, yeah, who had been the bomber, our bomber command liaison officer, yeah, and was now flying. The only Avro person was a rep, engineer, in the back. And very, very unfortunately, he had married my secretary only 6 weeks before the airplane had gone to Australia, and she would come in during the course of the morning, knowing that they were on their way back, asking what's the latest news, to which I was able to say they're over the Mediterranean or they're over Paris. And then there was a long silence, and Reuter came on the telephone and asked if I could throw any light on the accident to the Vulcan at Heathrow. It's a very, very sad occasion for everyone.
What was behind the accident at Sybil?
That was 770, the first prototype, which was on loan to Rolls-Royce for Conway development for the Victor. It happened on a Saturday. I was playing golf at Wimslow, and halfway round I was asked by the club secretary to go to a telephone because I had got to tell a widow that her husband had been killed in a Vulcan. And I said, no, it can't be, because we haven't got any Vulcans flying today. He said, well, that's the message. And then, of course, I discovered that it was the Rolls-Royce aeroplane which had been demonstrating at Syston. And the co-pilot was on loan from Fairies, a great friend of ours. And so my wife and I had to drive to her house and, Maureen, Jimmy, come in. I was well, not quite like that. Sit down, Pat. Some bad news for you. And I'm afraid the aeroplane had exceeded its speed limit and had applied too much aileron, and the wing had folded up. Perhaps not altogether surprising that it had exceeded the speed limit, because they were four very powerful engines, and I suppose the pilot had got rather carried away and had held full throttle level flight too long. Yeah. There was a film taken by a member of the public which proved invaluable in determining the origin and the rate of growth of the structural failure.
So when you finished on the Vulcan, you moved on to...
Well, that's right. With the Vulcan in service, it was necessary to look around the civil market, and we elected to go for a 40-seat twin dart aeroplane to compete with the Friendship and the Herald.
And then you had the military version of the Andover as well that came along.
Yes, yes. We became aware of the need for an aeroplane for the outback, like Aden. And we were told that the Herald had demonstrated on a ploughed field at Martlesham Heath very successfully. And if we were to stand a chance of getting the contract for the military version, we had to do the same. It was January, and I knew that the Herald had been there in August. I was able to find a civil servant at the Air Ministry who knew something of this strip, and I telephoned him and said, how will it differ from last August? Oh, the soil is very, very special. It never changes, however wet it is. Could he please come to the demonstration? So I said, well, you must have seen the strip many times. Oh, I've never actually seen it. I just wrote the specification for it. Well, you won't be surprised to hear that he was totally and utterly wrong. The ploughed strip was in a terrible state. When I tell you that the width of the strip was narrower than the wingspan, you'll understand that it was necessary to do some fairly fierce taxiing in order to do a U-turn on the so-called runway. But the 748 behaved itself extraordinarily well, so much so that I was able to invite a lot of senior brass, both from the Army and the Royal Air Force, to enjoy a ride as passengers. And they did. And I like to think that that demonstration was one of the helpful factors in getting the contract for 31 handovers. We then, when the first production handover arrived, we were invited by the Royal Air Force to demonstrate in Aden, where we were required to do 25 takeoffs and landings from the four worst strips they could find. Again, the aeroplane outshone itself, and despite some extraordinary surfaces, the only thing we ever had to change was one main wheel, where the tire was cut to cord by a sharp stone. But then, of course, we gave Aden back, and so really the Andover was never used in its primary role for short rough field operation.
Now, these were fairly large low pressure tires, were they?
Yes, they were, but nothing extraordinary to look at. I suppose the only silly thing that happened during the course of that stay in Aden, where we had an AID inspector with us to look after the taxpayers' interests, we had a nose wheel which had a bubble of inner tube protruding from the cover. And so I made a proud announcement to the team from Boscombe Down and the AID chap that Averroes would now demonstrate how you could change a nose wheel in 5 minutes flat. A spare nose wheel was brought out from the fuselage, only to discover that it had never been inflated. We had been warned that we were safe on this strip from terrorists until 12 noon, but not beyond. So I invited the foreman in charge of our shop floor team to strap up this bulging piece of inner tube with adhesive tape. He made a jolly good job of this, whereupon the AID inspector said he wasn't sure that he could allow this. So I said, well, I'm not sure what the alternative is. It's now 1 o'clock, and we were safe here until 12. Well, I'm still not sure. I said, well, are you flying it back or am I? He said, well, you know I can't. So I said, right, shut up, climb aboard, we're going back. And I tell you what, I'll bet you a quid that the tyre is still inflated when we taxi in at Cormaxa. And it was.